It's a little difficult to look at people wherever you happen to be and to recognize the fact that they are spiritually dead if they are outside of Christ. You can't see it. I mean, it's not that they're inactive. They're very active. But they're spiritually dead. And they need the new birth in a desperate kind of way. And perhaps because we live in a material, physical universe, perhaps it's even more difficult to realize that when you look at a child that's so healthy and full of boundless energy and enthusiasm, that that child is dying physically. I mean, you can't see it. You can't see this weakening of bodily powers, gaining a susceptibility to disease, decaying of the physical organism, resulting in the ultimate dissolution of the union of soul, spirit, and body, with the consequent extinction of physical life. You can't really see that. And when people are young and they feel so strong and so full of energy, they can go from morning till night. It's hard to believe that they're physically marked by death. And that this refers to all human beings in the world. Some of these other things you can't see either if you're looking just through physical eyes or looking through the eyes of various disciplines, uninformed by scriptural truth. The loss of original righteousness, the loss of communion with God, guilt. Can't see that, guilt and condemnation. You may be able to see the feelings of guilt. In some cases, the incurring of God's wrath and curse so that every human being outside of Christ has the wrath of God, the great anger of God resting upon him, upon her. And bondage to Satan. People don't feel that. People don't see that. It's not something you can see or put your finger on. When you lump those seven things together, it's a pretty hard case. And you know, it doesn't matter whether you look at Augustine or Anselm or Aquinas or Calvin or Luther or Knox or Zwingli. It really doesn't matter whether you look at Wesley or Hodge or Thiessen or Strong or Shedd. It doesn't matter where people come from in terms of their background. These seven things all obtain. It's just a very, very hard case. And it needs a very powerful antidote. Again, we tend to overlook these things, I guess because we live in a physical world and we look through physical eyes and we don't see these things on the surface. And maybe we pretend or we lull ourselves to sleep or something of that sort. We don't apply these theological truths to the people around us, to the life situations, especially to our loved ones. Because that really makes that a hard case. On the other hand, taking these seven together can form a very powerful warrant for the gospel and world evangelization. Very powerful. It's a good thing we don't have to stop here. It's a good thing there is gospel, there is good news. Wesley felt, quite frankly, that you really couldn't understand gospel unless you had it against this kind of a background. Calvin felt you couldn't understand the grace of God unless you saw it against this dark background. Now tonight, our burden is on the long-range results of the fall to Adam's posterity. You notice that all of Adam's posterity come into the world spiritually dead. They need to be born again. They lack original righteousness. They have no righteousness of their own. They stand naked before God. They're cut off from communion with God. Not cut off in the sense that He doesn't providentially guide their lives, but cut off in the sense that they have no real oneness, fellowship with God. That's what is cut off. They're guilty and they're condemned. They're under God's wrath and curse. They're in bondage to Satan and they're physically dying. Now, two areas. Adam's guilt, imputation. Adam's corruption, impartation. You notice the distinction between words. Imputation of guilt, impartation of corruption or depravity. Toward the bottom of page 127. Imputation of guilt, impartation of corruption or depravity. Now, what does impute mean? We've got to get clear on this. To impute, I suggest, means to mentally charge something negative against a person or to mentally credit something positive to a person. It's a transaction which takes place first in the mind, whether in the mind of God or in the mind of a human being, to impute, to credit or charge something to someone. Now, if I impute selfishness to someone, I don't impart anything, communicate anything to the person. I make a mental judgment. I say that person is selfish. I impute selfishness. I may do so wrongfully. I may do that wrongfully. I may do it on the surface, appearance. Christ said, judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. And I may do it according to appearance only. I may look and say, that person's selfish. And I may completely misunderstand, misinterpret. That's very possible to do. But in any case, even if I'm doing it wrong, I don't communicate anything to the person. I don't make the person selfish. See, that's the point. To impute selfishness does not mean to make a person selfish. If I impute greediness to a person, I don't make the person greedy. What I'm doing is mentally charging that person with greediness. Now, the person may have no awareness of the fact that I'm doing it, you know? They don't know what's going on in my head, but I'm charging that person with greediness. Now, if I'm doing it properly, judging righteous judgment, I have to do so on the basis of facts, and I have to do so on the ground of scriptural principles as to what greediness is, defining greediness. I see this person, here we are in the dining hall, and we're having family style, and there's a large bowl of potatoes going around, and there are 8 people at the table, and it comes to this one person, and he takes a spoon and takes half the bowl and scoops it on his plate. I look at that, you know, with my eyes big. I've seen that happen, by the way. I saw that in college. Some people who hadn't been socialized. In any case, I see the person, candy dishes being handed around. Person takes a great big handful, fills his pockets, and then takes another handful and starts eating. And after a number of things like that, I begin to attribute greediness, to charge greediness to the person. Now, again, it may be something I don't know anything about. The person may have a craving for potatoes and sweets and can't help himself or herself, although that's less likely than the greediness business. All right. But then it may be the other thing, too. So I'd have to find out more facts. I'd have to get more information. In any case, it's not communicating greediness to the person. I may say nothing. I may hint at nothing to the person. I'm standing there as a spectator virtually. And I'm imputing greediness to the person. Well, now, in Psalm 32, it says, Blessed is the one whose sin is not charged against him. His sin is not charged against him. In Romans 4:6, God credits righteousness apart from works to a person, and that person is called blessed. Now, to impute righteousness or to impute guilt does not mean to communicate righteousness, subjective righteousness, to make the person subjectively righteous. Doesn't mean to communicate guilt in the sense of making the person guilty. Doesn't mean that at all. It means to charge righteous or charge guilt or credit righteousness to an individual. And you could heap up cases in which the words both Old and New Testament are used to show that. That's not the problem. Notice in 2 Corinthians page 128, 519, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them. And in a classic text, 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf. Now, he didn't make Christ sinful in his nature. He didn't make Christ sinful in actions. But what he did was he made him to be sin on our behalf, that is, charged our sin against his son. Didn't make his son subjectively sinful. Didn't make his son commit a sinful act, but charged our sin to his son. He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him, so that they might credit his righteousness to us. That's imputation. That's the classic text, by the way. 2 Corinthians 5:21. Now, with that idea in mind, we want to look at this classic passage in Romans chapter 5. Now, you could put this right opposite the page on which the translation is located, because the hole is on the right side instead of on the left. Thank you. anybody not get one? Okay. You've read through the verse-by-verse comments, and you have the Greek text before you, and the NASB translation of the Greek text. NASB tends to be very literal. And you can look at the Greek text as we go along. Literal. Did I say liberal? I meant literal. The NASB strives to be overly literal, and as a result, the translation is somewhat stiff and a bit wooden at times. But the translators tried very carefully to adhere to the text and not so much to put it into modern, flowing English. The NIV, on the other hand, although they strive for accuracy as well, they try to put it into English that is up to date and that flows and is readable, quite readable in English. What they strive for is what is sometimes called dynamic equivalence. Instead of word for word or phrase for word, phrase, correspondence. They try to capture the idea and put it in modern words. And so you lose something and you gain something on both sides. The NIV is so easy to read and so flowing as English, and it's so modern. The NASB has some expressions in it that are older, hark back to an older age, not as far back as the Authorized Version, but the King James. But still, you gain something in accuracy as far as literalness, but you lose something in readability. So it's a trade-off. Depends what you want to do with it. Ray. I really haven't done enough work with the New King James to make that kind of judgment. I have to look at that. Anybody done some work with the New King James? Yes, Brian. Let me ask you a couple probing questions and you can show me my ignorance. Is the main burden of the New King James to take out all the obsolete expressions and bring the obsolete expressions into modern?
That's what it looks like to me. It looks like it takes the King James and takes out the these and the thous.
So they basically retain the King James translation. Oh, Rick, you were familiar with it too? And the New King James. Here's a man. See, he kept quiet there. He didn't say anything, then suddenly jumped in. Pardon? Oh, you agree. I see. I see. The two of you, what other things can you tell us about the New King James? Anything at all? Anything that occurs to you? Any impression or anything?
I think, to me, it seems like it's very easy to read. It's more like the NIV, but it keeps more of the King James language. But it takes out all of the, things that make sense.
Uh Okay.
I want to make a question.
Sure.
Growing up in down in the South, there's always a big deal going on about the King James, that people use the King James, I guess it was the 1611, that you were a serious heretic. Matter of fact, this is the first NIV that I've ever owned.
It's beautiful.
I
missed that, Steve. Oh, okay.
But, I mean, that's...
That's right.
You know, like, even at Liberty, I mean, that wasn't my set of Liberty where I went to school, but they often found the King James, but down in Texas, I mean, that was... If you didn't follow a particular thing to have an NASB or an NIV, I mean, that was terrible. I mean, what is the thinking of that?
Who's thinking?
That thinking. Just the very, you know, ultra-fundamental... I mean, even if you pick up, say, like the Sword of the Lord, or read that, you look at some of the things that they advertise in different colleges, and they put that in there, King James Version only, and then they put the little 1611 version only.
I don't think they use the 1611 version. No, they don't understand it at all.
The textus receptus, that whole argument, that whole issue, is a very hot issue in certain circles. And I think it will be and continue to be for some time. A lot of people don't use the King James because of the textus receptus issue. But I suppose it's what you're used to and what your leaders tell you to trust in. Of course, a lot of that is true, what your leaders tell you to trust in. There are some arguments that are made about the critical text on which the authorized version is based, as opposed to the texts of, say, the NASB and the NIV, of course. And those can be examined, although that's a long examination. Quite frankly, for years, I had to mentally, because I used the King James all the time, I had to mentally make the conversion. You know, I had to make the conversion to explain it to people. Each time I had to explain what it said, because so many of the expressions were so archaic and obsolete and weren't being used, and the thought forms were so... that I had to virtually translate the translation. And that was very onerous. It was very annoying to have to do that. And naturally, I was concerned when various other translations appeared to see whether or not they were representing the text properly, even aside from the textual difference issue, the differences of not only the families of text, but the textual questions that arose on specific points. But aside from that, if you know some Hebrew and some Greek, you're able to look at what it says in the original, compare it with a particular version, and say, they haven't captured it, or they've done it admirably. I mean, they've just grasped it beautifully. The problem is that sometimes in certain versions, I find they've grasped this verse beautifully or this psalm beautifully, but then on some other portion they haven't grasped it beautifully and there seems to be some distortion. And so there's no version that you can completely commend and say that I can second everything that's in this particular version. There are always going to be questions about this or that or the other thing. And on the thing I mentioned before, this literal plus woodenness, or this dynamic equivalence versus readability, that issue, it's a trade-off. That's what you have to do. You have to say, well, what am I willing to give in order to get? And I find myself that it's very helpful to me to do, in doing quick studies, to use the NASB. If I want to study something more slowly, then I go into the original languages and look at the issues, look at the questions. But for devotions, I use the NIV. See, because in devotions, I don't want to get hung up on issues of interpretation, and I want it readable. I want to be able to read through it and grasp it quickly. Not that the scriptures for devotion shouldn't be accurate, they should. But again, I have the advantage that if there is a problem that's called to my attention, I can always look at it and see what the problem is. And a lot of people don't have that ability because they don't know the languages. So it makes a problem. They can't evaluate versions. Again, you have to trust somebody. And it's nice if people that you're looking to at least spell out the reasons why they prefer this version or that version or the other version. That's helpful. There are some versions, Goodspeed, Moffat, which beautifully capture certain portions of the Psalms, just grasp them and express them so beautifully. There are certain portions in the King James that have a beautiful poetry to them that flow so wonderfully that you feel you're cheated if you lay aside those portions and read it in a perhaps more literal, but not poetic at all, even though it's poetry. See, you'd think that poetry would be translated poetically, wouldn't you? But you need a person with a special talent and gift to do that. And not all translators are like that. Well, enough of the aside. Here's the passage. Therefore, even as by one man sin entered the world. Now, this is the very literal translation. This is more literal than the NASB. And as a result, it's much more stiff. And in this way, death passed over to all men in that all sinned. Now, I suggest there that you could interpret this as saying, death passed over to all men because all individually sinned and therefore individually incurred death. You could interpret it that way. Death passed over to all men in that all sinned. But we don't have enough information yet in verse 12 to rule out or to confirm that particular view. So we go to verse 13. Now, verses 13 and 14 present a special problem. Until the law, sin was in the world. But sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. But death ruled from Adam until Moses, even upon those who did not sin after the likeness of the disobedience of Adam, who is the type of the coming one. Now, here's a strange thing. Until the law, sin was in the world. Now, if we put Adam here, and put Moses here,
associating the law with Moses.
It says, until the law, sin was in the world.
So if we run this to here, from Adam until Moses,
there was sin in the world. Now the problem is, how can you have sin charged to one's account when there is not law? I mean, if you say, until the law was given through Moses.
So you can see that after this, you have law, and that law rules during that particular time. But what do you have before that? It says, until the law, sin was in the world. But how can you have sin in the world without law?
Law defines sin. It tells us what sin is. By the law is the knowledge of sin. How can you have sin in the world? It says sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. Ah, you say, I see. You can have sin, but it isn't charged to your account. But what does that mean? Sin is in the world, but it's not charged to your account. Where is sin? Where is sin if it's not charged to your account? Well, you say, that's easy. You can have corruption in the world, but no guilt. Sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. Guilt is a legal term. So, no guilt, just corruption or depravity. Sinfulness, in other words. You can have sinfulness from Adam to Moses, but you can't have guilt. You can have corruption, but not guilt. Now, verse 14 says, but death ruled from Adam until Moses. See, that defines the parameters more closely now. Verse 14, Adam. See, in verse 13, you don't have Adam mentioned, just until the law. But verse 14 defines it, Adam until Moses. Death ruled even upon those who did not sin after the likeness of the disobedience of Adam. So, people here, before the flood, when people became extremely wicked, they were sinful. They were very sinful. But they didn't sin the way Adam sinned. They didn't transgress the way Adam transgressed. And yet, although they didn't transgress the way Adam transgressed, nevertheless they died. God said, in the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. But although death ruled, that is, they all died, they didn't die because they did what Adam did in transgressing the law of God. Death ruled from Adam until Moses, even though they didn't sin the same way Adam sinned. Adam sinned, and as a result, he died. They sin. Ah, somebody says, I see. They sin. And therefore they died. Adam sinned, he died. The day that you eat, you shall surely die. They sinned, and they died. But on the basis of what law? See, on the basis of the law given to Adam, he died because he transgressed the law, the covenant. But on what basis do they die? You say, well, they sinned. They transgressed what? Until the law. What did they transgress? Steve.
It sounds like you're saying like they had no direct revelation God's will to be disobedient somehow. You know, because like there wasn't the Mosaic law, therefore. And is there in the record of God directly laying down guidelines for it? But I don't understand how. I guess what I'm thinking of is the example of Cain and Abel. I mean, they knew that one was right and one was wrong. But there's not a. Was it offering what God had required or requested?
Well, let's look at the account. Let's look at the account. Best way to find out is look at what it says. Abel and Cain brought offerings to the Lord. They brought different kinds of offerings, but that's because they did different things. Cain was a tiller of the ground. He brought an offering from the stuff that grew out of the ground. Abel was a keeper of flocks. He brought that which he did. That was his occupation. He brought something of the flocks. There's no difference, really, as far as what they brought. One brought part of the flock, the other part of the vegetables. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, and then Cain became very angry because God had no regard for his offering. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? If you do not well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." So when they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Now, are you suggesting, Steve, that Cain knew?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that it seems like in this diagram, now it happens that it's kind of like implying an absence of direct revelation, that until the law, and I still, I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Well, so far, all I'm doing is saying what the passage is saying, okay? Trying to get at that in verses 13 and 14. That's all we're doing so far. Until the law, sin was in the world. Sin isn't charged when there is not law. But death ruled from Adam to Moses, even those who didn't sin the same way Adam sinned. Right.
And he said that sin is not imputed where there is no law. But you just said that they sinned, but not the same sin that Adam sinned.
Right.
Was this actual sin we're talking about here? Or?
Well, question, did they commit sins? Did they commit sins?
They sinned, but not the way Adam sinned.
Right, they didn't sin the way Adam sinned because his transgression was unique. They couldn't sin the way Adam sinned. They couldn't take of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So they, but is it indisputable that they that there was sin from Adam until Moses? Is it indisputable that there was such a thing as sin, that people sinned during that time?
Committed acts of sin.
I think that's fairly indisputable. Bart?
I said that even two more than the passage on Cain and Abel, when he killed his brother, you had the pronouncement, now you are either cursed and driven from the ground. That sure sounds like the penalty being given for sin. It's not false and it doesn't exist. Didn't you have God treating it as such, the same fashion in which he treated the sin that God committed? The idea of a curse specifically being mentioned as part of the penalty for Cain's activity, this particular action. I think that would argue.
And you have some strong statements just before the flood. Very strong. Jenny.
Also, don't have the law of God written on the heart.
Now, we haven't said anything about that. So the question is there a law functioning from Adam to Moses, as well as past Moses? But, I mean, is there a law functioning during that period? Now, see, Steve brought up the question, and it's a good question. Did God give any revelation, special revelation of law from Adam until Moses? I mean, he clearly gave a special revelation at the time of Moses. But before that, did he give any special revelation? This is sin, this is sin, this is sin, this is wrong, this is wrong. However, if we don't find specific revelation to that effect, either because the account is so telescoped or because God did not give it that way, we still have what Jenny suggested in Romans 2 and 14 and 15. The law of God written on man's heart, on man's nature at his creation. Now, that law of God, of necessity, would contain certain principles which would govern right and wrong conduct. And, of course, the question has to be raised, were those wiped out by the fall? Or do those principles still function? Well, in Romans 2, 14 and 15, Paul tells us they still function. They still function. There may be very definite damage done to those principles, and they may not be said to function without error, that is, infallibly, but they function. Well, if you can go through the fall that way and see that Cain and Abel, the people before the flood, they had the law of God written on the heart, and they were held responsible to that, and they also had conscience, and they were held responsible for that. Well, the law of God written in the heart has to then relate us, without getting into anything else yet, to sin. The law tells us what sin is. The conscience either accuses or excuses. And that was true from Adam until Moses. All right. So, until the law, sin was in the world. Sin is transgression of the law of God. They had the law of God written on their heart, on their nature. That was not wiped out by the fall. So they were transgressing the law of God in that sense. But sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. Right.
Perhaps he's speaking of a different order of law, or a different kind of law, something external. So because of its imputation, if it's done in the mind, if it's imputed by someone else, or someone else imputes something to me, there has to be a standard that we both agree on. And it could not be the standard of one's conscience or the law within me, because there would be a dispute as to whether or not I was reading it properly.
Yeah.
It would have to be something given from God that would govern the people as a whole. And that could have been only done from the law of Moses.
Now, if God looks upon the people from Adam until Moses, and he sees them sinning, does not God mentally charge them with sinning?
Because I don't know what right to have. You read it that way. I always read it that the sin is not imputed where there is a law. It's meaning God being the one who's imputing it. But it could be something other than that.
There are two possibilities suggested in the text of the class notes. One has to do with guilt. Sin in terms of guilt was not charged to men's accounts. The other brings a hypothetical objector into the picture, so that you read verse 13 this way. Paul, until the law, sin was in the world. Hypothetical objector. But sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law. Now, Paul brings in a hypothetical objector from time to time in his writings. And he brings the hypothetical objector in as a foil against which to play his ideas.
So he's saying even though the law of Moses was given, it's still a law in operation. So it's not like identical to the law of Moses.
Yeah, right. It's not. Yes, it's not identical to the law of Moses. You have to say that. Now, Bernard Herring, a Roman Catholic theologian who has done a great deal of work on ethics, suggests, and when I first read this in him, I was very surprised that I hadn't recognized it before. He suggests that the law of Moses is essentially a republication of the law of God written on the heart at creation, with a lot added, with a lot of material added, dietary laws, all sorts of things of that sort, and civic things, because now you've got God is dealing with a nation, and so on. But the suggestion is that as far as the moral aspects of the law of Moses, you've got a republication of the law of God. One was written into men's hearts, the other is written on tables of stone and then enlarged as given through Moses. That's a kind of an interesting idea, a republication. It also links together nicely the law of God written in the heart and the law of God given through Moses in special revelation. And you'd expect there to be some relationship between the two, the law written in the heart and the law written on tables of stone given through Moses. Death ruled from Adam until Moses. Death ruled. Death ruled. Now, if the explanation is, well, sure, death ruled, men sinned and they died. That is, sin was a punishment, death was a punishment visited upon people who sinned. Just as death was a punishment visited upon Adam and Eve. So each individual sinned from Adam to Moses and each individual died. Purely individualistic, no corporate relationship, no continuity between them. It's curious, however, that these people died even though they didn't sin the same way that Adam had sinned. And there is no revelation of law from Adam until Moses that says, if you sin in this way or in any way, you shall surely die. There's no revelation to that effect. As a matter of fact, curiously enough, these people from Adam until Moses, after the fall, appear to come into the world already dead and dying. Not as being innocent, I'm using innocent in the wrong way there. Not as being without sin. Innocent you can use in the sense of not having committed a sin. That is, as infants, you can say they had not yet committed a sin, so they're innocent of transgression. But nevertheless, they come into this world spiritually dead and physically dying. And this sentence of death is not visited upon them as a judgment for their sins. I mean, they're infants. Before they transgress, before they do good or evil, they come into this world dead and dying. Steve. Okay. Now, this raises a very interesting question. Here, you don't have a law from Adam until Moses that says, if you sin, you will die. You don't have that. Now, you have that with Adam. If you sin, you will die. But you don't have it, if you sin, you will die, here. Now, here, from then on, you can ask, is there a law like that? If you sin, you will die. Well, if you mean die in terms of civic punishment, in terms of execution for capital crimes, that's one thing. And you could say, well, there is incorporated in the Mosaic corpus that idea of death. Just as you have in the New Testament, Romans 3:23, very famous passage. And then Romans 6:23 added on top of that, the wages of sin is death. You could say you have that principle incorporated into the Mosaic legislation, whether it's expressed explicitly or not. Well, in any case, you notice that death rules, even though there is no law, no law in the sense of a codified law, which says, if you sin, you will die. Nevertheless, death rules here. And curiously enough, we're going to see later, death rules here. And the question is, does it rule because individuals sin and God visits the punishment of death upon them for their individual transgressions? Now, if you take verse 13 as a hypothetical objector, wait a minute, he says, sin is not charged when there is no law. Then Paul answers verse 14, but death ruled from Adam until Moses. So Paul, verse 13, until the law, sin was in the world. Paul, in verse 14, death ruled from Adam until Moses. Sin was in the world, death was in the world, from Adam until Moses. And yet, although there was no law in that sense, yet there was sin. And here where there is law, there was sin. So there was sin here, and there was sin here. But these people, from Adam until Moses, did not die because they transgressed a law which said, if you transgress this law, you shall surely die. You don't have that. And yet, they sinned, and yet they died. Very fascinating. They sinned, and they died. Now, in verse 15, let's see where this takes us. In verse 15, but not as the transgression, so also the gift. Very curious way of expressing it. You would not have said it that way. But not as this, so also this. If you're going to make a comparison, you say, as this, therefore this. You don't say, not as this, so this. That's, you know, that sounds contradictory. And Paul says it in a very peculiar way. Not as the transgression, so also the gift. He says there's a similarity here, comparison and analogy that may be made, but there's an unlikeness in it. There's a likeness and there's an unlikeness. For if by the transgression of one,